live from the middle of America in the middle of the freaking night. This is TruthNet Radio's TNR Live. My name is Mike Chambers. It is a Monday night, January 15th into the 16th. Glad you're with us. Good program tonight. I'm kind of worried here. Part two of Eustace Mullins tonight, minus one segment. I recorded this interview at another location, and I brought it over with me. Everything was great on Friday night when we ran the show. Tonight, one segment won't run. So as we were trying to load it up, we got two segments for you that we're going to run, and then we'll get into news in the second hour. Later on this week, Dr. Jerome Corsi on Friday night is going to be our guest. We're going to talk about the North American Union. Folks, this is big, big stuff. And if you haven't been following what's going on with the North American Union and this SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, you need to dig in and get ready. Be sure to be here on Friday night for the program. I'm going to talk in the next hour about a couple in New Hampshire basically being railroaded by the system. And it's all over those dadgum income taxes. And they're not allowed to present their evidence, anything. And so we're going to get into that here in the next hour, plus your phone calls as well at 800-451-1567. 800-451-1567. But a good show coming up nonetheless with Eustace Mullins. And what I'll do is I'll get the missing segment that we have, which is right in the middle of the interview. And we'll put that all together. Now, I'll probably piece it all together where I may just make the whole thing available in one big download. So you get the whole thing all at once. It's a good piece. I was just the opportunity to talk with him, I thought was just was incredible. Here's this guy, 85 years old, that knows so much. And is just there just dishing it out. A piece at a time, and they're giving it to me just about as fast as I wanted it. So, we'll have that coming up here for you in just a few minutes. The chat room is open at the TruthNet Radio website at TNRLive.com. TNRLive.com. An easier way for you to get the website, as opposed to having to type in TruthNet Radio in all the way. But TNRLive.com will get you there. A lot of stuff going on here in the Patriot movement and that type of thing, and we're gonna get into some of that, I guess. I don't know. We may talk about it here a little bit. There seems to be a battle of brewing, possibly, and we'll get into that here as well. Real quick, want to talk about our sponsor for the program tonight, silver-investor.com. That's silver-investor.com. If you've thought about investing in precious metals in any way, right now you need to be going to silver-investor.com. Everybody knows the dollar is on the skids, and people are looking for ways to keep their money safe, keep their money good, be able to invest money and make money, as opposed to having their money just be worth nothing. Since the start of the Federal Reserve in 1913, the dollar has fallen 97%. That's a lot. Meanwhile, in the last 3 years, silver has risen over 300%. So you can see the disparity here. When silver is going up, the dollar continues to go down. That obviously people may be wanting to think about making some changes in their investment portfolio. Silver-investor.com, or you can Google just Silver Investor. Go there, go to the website, get signed up on the free email list. That'll get you information on a regular basis. There's no obligation. Plus, you're going to get the 10 rules of silver investing at absolutely no cost. That'll go straight to you as a gift from them. Plus, if you're serious about things, you can check out a subscription. $99 until the end of the month, and it goes up to $129. at the end of January, so you're going to want to cash in on that. Plus, a great little contest they've got running as well there at silver-investor.com. That's silver-investor.com. All right, well, here's our interview. Ladies and gentlemen, with Eustace Mullins, part two, like I said, minus one segment. Let's talk about the Cold War, because because that was not a hot war, so to speak. But I get this, you know, a distinct feeling that you're going to tell me that basically the same group of folks were responsible for the 40 years of Cold War as well.
Well, that was a totally fake. The Cold War was entirely artificial, and I exposed that in I found an article in American Heritage magazine of April 1977. By a very noted historian, Christopher Mee, and Christopher Mee explained that the whole thing was conjured up by Truman. They decided that Churchill had decided we should break with Russia, and they would create a Cold War between Russia. And so the senators told him that if he did that, he'd have to scare the hell out of the American people. And so that was where terrorism was born. They convinced the American people they were about to be nuclear bombed by the Soviet Union at any moment, and so they accepted the Cold War entirely. And Norman Podhoretz, who was one of the chief Israeli propagandists in this country, he was a publisher of Commentary, which was the official organ of the American Jewish Committee. And Norman Podhoretz published his autobiography a couple of years ago, in which he said that the Cold War was simply conjured out of nothing so that the American people would continue to pay for the defense of Israel. And so Forrestal, the first Secretary of Defense, was murdered because he began to object. They were stripping the entire armament of the United States and sending it to Israel, and he objected to it. And so they pushed him out the window, and that was the end of that.
there's still a lot of talk about that murder to these days. This day about Forrestal being.
Well, his son was very bitter about it because he knew he was murdered, and so they haven't had a Secretary of Defense since Forrestal who objected to anything.
Well, you know. So we have Truman basically creating the idea of terrorism.
That was all created because Menachem Begin, the Prime Minister of Israel, was on 60 Minutes about 20 years ago, and he was being interviewed by Mike Wallace, and so Mike Wallace was talking about terrorism, and he said to Begin, he said, "Well, you really created terrorism in the Middle East, didn't you?" And Menachem Begin said, "Oh no, it's much better than that." He said, "We brought terrorism to the entire world," which they did, and it's been here ever since.
You know, and I that's one piece of history as well, Mr. Mullins, that a lot of people don't realize the conflict over there in the Middle East. You know, before the foundation of Israel was very, very bloody, and these individuals like Menachem Begin, Ariel Sharon, these guys were very ruthless individuals.
All about their terrorist organization was known all over the world, and so Begin boasted that they really brought terrorism to the whole world because they did, and we're still suffering from it, and we'll continue to suffer from it.
Yeah,
see, there was no terrorism. This was all created by Woodrow Wilson at the Versailles Peace Conference in 1919, when they broke up the Ottoman Empire and the Turkish Empire. They chopped it up into all these little Arab states who all hated each other because there was no unity among the Arab peoples whatsoever.
Right.
And they kept on fighting each other all the time. In fact, they promoted the war between Iraq and Iran, in which millions of Arabs were killed. That was all promoted by Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, because actually Iraq and Iran had no conflict at all.
No.
They had nothing, no reason to fight.
No, I mean, if you were expecting a battle between between Arab nations over there, it would have been Iran and Saudi Arabia because they hate each other.
Yeah, well, some of the Arab nations hated each other more than others, but Iran and Iraq had never had any problems whatsoever.
Exactly, yeah.
And they launched in this very bloody war, which Iraq really never recovered from.
No, and then, I mean, what that war ended in about 90, and then in 91, we roll in with our little version of shock and awe because we're liberating Kuwait when Kuwait, I guess, had been slant drilling into Iraq's oil reserves. And then,
And Saddam Hussein, that was deliberately created by Saddam Hussein by the CIA. It was the conflict between Iraq and Iran was totally, came out of Washington. They had no quarrel whatsoever. And that was run by George Bush, and that's when they put Saddam Hussein in as the head of Iraq. So, actually, at the time of Saddam's execution a few weeks ago, he had been working for the CIA for 34 years for Judge Bush. And so I complained to everybody. I said, I don't understand why they're prosecuting Saddam Hussein, because he's worked for the CIA for 34 years and he's due a pension.
Well, that or at least a transfer.
Well, yes.
You know, I mean,
well, he didn't deserve lynching because everything he did was on orders from the CIA, and these so-called atrocities that he committed in Iraq were done at the behest of the CIA itself.
Well, and plus,
George Bush.
April Glaspie, who was an ambassador for the United States, you know, basically told him that you know, inter Arab affairs were none of our concern, and to do what he needed to do. So
yeah.
He just rolls right into Kuwait. Well, we can't have that. We've got babies being thrown on the floor and incubators going
on. Well, he was assured that the United States would make no objection to it.
Right.
In fact, it was practically a CIA operation.
Yeah.
And they made a lot of money out of that. Everybody in the oil business made a lot of money because that enabled them to boost the price of oil all over the world. And there's no telling how many billions of dollars they got out of that.
You know, you mentioned George Bush there a moment ago, and his rise to power is really kind of an interesting story in the fact that here's a guy, you know, his father, Prescott, was a two-term senator from Connecticut, and he was never tried or convicted for trading with the enemy, but George Bush's story, here's a guy who runs for Congress twice, is defeated both times, but just suddenly shows up in the Nixon administration.
Yeah. Well, he really was a complete nonentity in Washington, and I never had any contact with him when I was up there. That was a little later, actually. But Bush was, Reagan took him on as vice president, and then, of course, when Reagan left office, they were very disappointed in Bush because he was a very colorless personality.
Right.
And Reagan was a very polished actor, and he was very articulate, and everybody liked him. So Bush was a great disappointment to them, but he carried through, and actually was fed up with Washington anyway. And so when he decided to run for office himself against Clinton, he made no effort to fight Clinton at all, because he and Clinton were partners in the Men of Drug operation in Arkansas. They were working together. They weren't rivals at all. And he just more or less stood aside and let Clinton be elected.
Well, and proof of that is the fact, you know, every time you turn around, you're seeing him. I mean, Bill Clinton is almost the son George Bush never had.
Oh, yes. Well, they're still close today. It's an amazing situation.
You know, and I mean, you know, during campaigns, they said terrible things about each other, and they're looking. I saw an interview with them about a year ago, and they're both going, oh, we like each other fine. And Clinton's talking about how he goes up to Kennebunkport all the time and hangs out with the Bushes.
Yeah. Well, you see, Clinton is an anomaly himself because he was the son of one of the Rockefellers, Winthrop. And he had Bill Clinton by Bill's mother, and that was never brought out, but it was common knowledge.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but I know that the that the Harrimans provided the the money and the backing for him.
Oh yes. He had plenty of money backing all the time because he was sort of chosen. I began to read in the New York Times in 1953 about a rising young politician in Arkansas, and for some reason the New York Times was running glowing tales about this wonderful man in Arkansas, and it was Bill Clinton. And so I was reading the New York Times at that time, and I said, my gosh, they're going to make that man president. I didn't know the rest of his background at that time. But I said, my gosh, they're going to put this guy in the White House.
Yeah.
Because you don't see the New York Times putting out effort that had for somebody if they haven't got grand plans for him.
Right.
So that was all preordained that he should be in the White House.
The issue of Zionism in the Patriot movement comes up an awful lot. And the question I've had about Zionism and Zionists, are Zionists the controller of things, or are they just another set of soldiers in this whole cabal that was created by the bankers so many years ago?
Well, that was all created. Zionism was created. You see, the Rothschild family in Frankfurt, Germany, in 1838, they were building up all sorts of things because they were taking over Europe, and so they suddenly came out with Karl Marx in 1838 with the doctrine of communism. And they came out with they got Rabbi Herzl to create the doctrine of Zionism, and then they had Hitler to create Nazism, and Mussolini create fascism. All those fascism, Nazism, communism, and Zionism all came out of the Rothschild offices in Frankfurt, Germany.
All the isms, and they so long ago had decided on this one world government, and because. Again, you know, one world government, it's easier to make money. It's easier to control things.
Oh, it is. The more control you have, the more money you make. You can't have any competition because everything becomes a monopoly, so there's no competition, so the people in power can make all the money they want.
Yeah.
And since they have no competition, they can charge any price they want.
Right.
So it creates an ideal situation.
Yeah,
and they call that capitalism. It's not capitalism at all. It's more communism. But the doctrines of capitalism, communism, Nazism, and fascism, and Zionism are all so close that you can't separate one from the other.
Right.
And it's always the same people running all five systems.
Always, and that's the. To me, is the most troubling thing because, again, the one thing about it, at least you know who you're fighting in this whole deal.
Because if you don't know who your enemy is, you're helpless.
Right. You know,
see, we fought World War II, and I'll tell you, my buddies in World War II were not, I won't say they were unpatriotic, but they didn't take the Germans or the Italians very seriously. And when we marched on drill parade, we would sing songs making fun of Eleanor Roosevelt and of the dog follow and FDR. And that was true in England, too. They made fun of Winston Churchill. Nobody took him seriously. He was considered an old drunk more than anything else. Because I had German officers told me that in their messes at night they would sit around making fun of Winston Churchill, listening to his radio broadcast, you know.
Right.
There was no passion to worship for Winston Churchill at all in England. He was considered a second-rater from the word go.
Now, what did you do in the Air Force?
Oh, I was a radar man, and so I was pretty busy. They kept me busy, but...
Now, were you overseas, or did you stay in the States?
I stayed in the States because I had a very high IQ. I had 127 IQ, and the Air Force wouldn't let me go. They kept me in schools all the time, and they finally scheduled me to go to Guam early in 1945, but then they dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima, and that was the end of the war.
So no Guam for you then, huh?
No, I didn't get any overseas. Of course, I'd like to get some overseas time because that's a good part of your record to have. But I didn't get it, but I've obeyed every orders they gave me, and I went wherever they told me to.
Now, did you volunteer for World War II, or were you drafted?
Oh, I was volunteering because I was living in a small town, and which I'm still living in, and there was no opportunities here. So, actually, young people welcome World War II as a chance to get away and have some fun, see some of the world.
Yeah. Except for you, you didn't get to see any of it.
No, I didn't. Well, I got to see most of the country. They kept shipping around the United States to school after school, which I was not interested in. I had no mechanical aptitude whatsoever.
But you were working, well, you were working with a cutting edge technology. You know, radar was new, and you know, you were probably one of a few that had had their hands on.
Well, I was in on the ground floor of television because we were getting. I got that training in 1943.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So I could have gone right into television and technologically and done quite well, but I had no interest in it because I was a writer. And that was all I wanted to do, so I never paid any attention to it.
Right. And I think it's to our benefit that you chose not to go into television.
Pardon?
I said it's to our benefit you chose not to go into television.
I never had any interest in getting into that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, I had no idea how bad it was going to become.
You know,
at that time, that seemed to be a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they turned it into a total mess.
You know, more and more is coming out about the, you know, this conspiracy revolving around Roosevelt and Pearl Harbor.
Oh, yes.
You know, I know Tom, husband Kimmel's grandson, Tom Kimmel.
Oh, yes, I met him at a meeting a while back, a very nice person, and he has tried to overcome his father's dishonor for all these years. And he petitioned Bush to reconsider the accusations against his father. And Bush replied to him, he said, "I cannot rewrite history." And so that made Kimmel, of course, very angry because that was a put-off remark.
Well, even that, though, you know, it's obvious, you know, if you look at the fact that we had hold of the Japanese diplomatic code, we could read it faster than they could. We knew what was going to happen, and that, you know...
It was well known. Do you know that all the time the Japanese were traveling towards Honolulu... they had intership broadcasting, and their broadcasts were being picked up on California and Washington, and so everybody on the West Coast knew that the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor.
Well, and I found something very interesting. I did I went looking for some old audio cuts from December 7th, and there was on one website I came across, there was an ad that had run a commercial on the radio. In October of 1941, it was Esso Oil, ESSO, and they were talking about the fact that gasoline was a very important defense commodity and needed to be conserved.
Oh, yes.
You know, and I thought that was very, very interesting. It was also very telling that it seemingly everybody knew we were going to war.
Well, I've told the audiences for many years the story of the night before Pearl Harbor. I said, Franklin D. Roosevelt and Bernard Baruch, who was the architect of the Versailles Peace Conference, which made World War II possible. I said, George Marshall and Bernard Baruch and Roosevelt were sitting there in the White House, and they were absolutely panicking because they were terrified that the Japanese would be discovered by an American airplane and that they would turn back. The Japanese had firm orders that if they were discovered in any way, they should turn back to Japan and not attack Pearl Harbor.
Right.
And so Roosevelt and Bush, I mean, Marshall and Baruch were terrified that the whole plans for World War II would just collapse overnight. There was nothing they could do about it.
You know, it's funny there in a way, you know, as you stumbled over who the name you were looking for, really, these people, they're interchangeable. You know, because they all, again, you know, the history repeats itself. And I've often wondered if, you know, they say that those that don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And it seems that we just never learn from history. We just keep on repeating it, running the...
Oh, we repeat it without any concept. Well, it's very much like when Napoleon attacked Russia, and his plans for world empire just collapsed right there. And Hitler did the same thing. He goes marching into Russia, and he followed the whole Napoleon conquest and everything. And that was the end of Hitler. Hitler was the master of Europe when he marched into Russia.
Right.
And everything went down the drain.
Yeah, and yeah, and the only thing to survive out of World War II is the Volkswagen.
Yes. Well, another thing that survived World War II was Avril Harriman.
Yes.
Because, see, Hitler had a complete nervous breakdown when Stalin had a nervous breakdown when he heard that Hitler was attacking, because he knew that his army was totally demoralized and that they couldn't resist Hitler. So he had a complete nervous collapse, and he was in the hospital. So the Roosevelt immediately sent Avril Harriman to Moscow, and he took over the Russian Empire during World War II for 2 years, from 1942 to 1944. Avril Harriman was actually the dictator of Russia.
Well, let me ask you this, Mr. Mullins. Was Hitler's attacking Russia, was that part of the scripted plan? Because I mean, so much, you know, the United States made a lot of money sending military supplies to Russia. I mean, all the
oh yes, they did. Lend-lease, they sent at least $100 billion there, and somebody made a lot of money out of that.
Yeah, you know, England have finally paid their lend-lease bill off this year, just late last year.
Pardon?
England paid their lend-lease bill off last year.
Oh, they did?
Yes.
They certainly did make the. I did see something very small in the paper about it.
Yeah, it was very small.
But it seemed to be of no importance.
But I don't think
that they really paid it off.
They probably
did some money transfers and so forth.
Well, it was all on paper. It's all out of thin air.
Oh, it's all paper, and it was a paper debt, and it was paid with paper.
There you go.
I don't think that we got anything out of it at all, because England couldn't have afforded to pay off the debt.
But from
England is bankrupt anyway.
But from a banker's standpoint, Russia's entry into World War II must have been like the gold mine, because I mean, you know, here's a country that has really no industry whatsoever. You know, and so we're supplying all their aircraft, their ships, and all their materiel. Man, that just had to, it must have been a boon.
Oh, it was a tremendous boon. In fact, Henry Ford was one of the biggest beneficiaries, because all the tanks and trucks that Roosevelt sent to Stalin were produced at Ford's River Rouge plant in Detroit. So Ford must have gotten a tremendous amount of money out of that.
Yeah, that's, you know, because again, as Woodrow Wilson says, all wars are due to economics, and you know, you have just tremendous amounts of money flowing, and so it makes it even easier to see why war in Iraq is so desirable by those in power.
Oh, the war party gets tons of money, because that's why we're keeping the Iraq war going. Because see, when the elder George Bush attacked Iraq, the war only lasted a couple of weeks, and everybody thought that the second adventure would be the same thing, but they managed to keep it going through a very simple technique. You know, Henry Kissinger has kept the war going in Iraq single-handedly ever since Bush attacked over there.
Yeah.
And Bush, Kissinger put his personal manager in as the Gauleiter of Iraq when we went in there. That was Paul Bremer.
Right.
That was Kissinger's office manager.
Yeah. All right, more to come with Eustace Mullins. One more segment that we've got that's coming up here in a couple of minutes. He is really great. And some of his dates may be off just a little bit. Some of the names may be off just a little bit. I mean, my God, he's 85. We'll talk more with Eustace here in a couple of minutes. This is TruthNet Radio's TNR Live. We'll be right back. TruthNet Radio. It's TNR Live. Yes, indeed. Monday night into Tuesday morning, the 15th of January into the 16th. My name is Mike Chambers. Glad you're with us on the program. Tonight, going to get back to the final segment with Eustace Mullins. As I mentioned earlier, there's one segment that for some reason is not working. And what I think we'll do is I will post the entire interview unedited. And it's almost 2 hours. And I'll post it up on the website. I'll put it down at a bitrate where everybody can manage it, you know, without it being like a huge, you know, Mongo file. So we'll do that. And that way everybody can get a hold of the entire thing. And I'll try to do that tomorrow to get the entire thing up. Because once the segment that's missing is a dandy segment of information that he gives. Plus, he talks a lot about his time with Ezra Pound working on the book. And the fact that he lived at the Library of Congress and nobody knew it. He was basically just hiding out. So, quite an individual. And it was great talking with him, and I enjoyed it just absolutely immensely. And we'll talk a little bit more about Eustace after the top of the hour here. This is TruthNet Radio, TNR, live. Back to the interview with Eustace Mullins. Let me ask you this. What are your thoughts about September 11th?
Oh, September 11th, I have a lot of friends in New York, and everybody that lives in Manhattan is convinced that there was a put-up job out of Washington. They don't think any Arabs had anything to do with it. And in fact, that was the reaction of everybody in the Middle East. Every Arab government said that no Arabs had anything to do with it. And the New York Times printed that. They said only 15% of the people in Asia and the Middle East really believe that Arabs had anything to do with it.
Well, even Osama bin Laden said he didn't have anything to do with it.
Well, that's probably true. He's probably telling the truth. I don't know how he would have known anything about it because he has never been there and he had no acquaintance with the situation. Well, the interesting thing to me is that no one has ever been arrested for it.
No, only promoted. You know, the government officials that supposedly, you know, laid down on the job, all of them got promotions.
Well, the thing is that there was furious activity in the Twin Towers for 6 months before 9/11. They moved out whole floors of stuff, equipment and stuff, and they had all of the legal papers for most of the United States stored in those buildings.
Yeah, on Trade Center
7,
yeah.
All those papers disappeared.
Yeah, a lot of the papers for the Enron case for Ken Lay and Jeffrey Skilling were in Building 7 and a number of other cases. A lot of big mob and drug cases. And those papers.
Well, in fact, I saw in the New York Times that they said after 9/11 that there would be no legal activity in the entire state of New York for the next 6 months because all the papers were gone. And so you can imagine that how many criminals escaped jail because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, and there are many ties you know, to companies, you know, around like AIG and Kroll, who's a subsidiary of AIG, and how, you know, and how they were at one time responsible for the security there, but they even had ties back to the MENA drug operation as well.
Oh, yes.
You know, taking place in Arkansas. So, you know, again, it's all a giant circle. I mean, the war on drugs, the war on terror, you know, the war on drugs has been nothing where basically, you know, our government brings the drugs in, distributes them to the streets, and then you have your public face where you go out and actually fight the war.
Yes, and I think it contributed to the illegal alien problem, too, because destroying all those papers in New York, there were probably the names and addresses of practically every illegal alien in this country. And all that paperwork disappeared.
Yeah.
And we've been stuck with 10 million Mexicans ever since.
I think it's more like 40.
Oh, it's four. Well, that's a very conservative figure, million, I know.
Yeah, I think they're coming over about 10,000 a day.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, they're just pouring over. And now there's this North American Union that's coming about. And kind of wanted to get your take on what you think from the banker standpoint. You know, what are they trying to accomplish with this, you know, the possibility of a new currency? What do you see as their ultimate aim?
Oh, well, the currency's in a very fluid situation because the Federal Reserve dollars, which are not dollars at all, 52% of those Federal Reserve dollars in that debt are owned by China and Japan. And at some point, China and Japan have got to make up their mind what to do with this money, which is totally worthless.
Right.
So I don't know how they're going to handle it, but it won't be good for us, I can assure you.
No, but there's talk of a new currency with this North American Union called the Amero.
Oh.
And I don't know if you've heard that or not. And basically what it would be a currency similar to the Euro.
Yeah.
And so you would have the, you know, the disappearance of the dollar, and we, you know, as we merge with Canada and Mexico, the Canadian dollar would disappear and the peso would disappear, and you have this one currency.
Well, I think that's a bit of, I think that would probably be done eventually. Of course, we're going to lose a lot by that kind of deal. I mean, the American people are going to lose a lot by it.
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, just the fact that, you know, the fact now that you have 40 million, you know, probably 40 million illegals in this country now is already driving the wages down as it is.
Oh, yes.
And then you have the fact that, you know, that eventually all of these cheap goods that are coming in now, as wages continue to drop, eventually the law of supply and demand will act in reverse, where instead of these items being cheap and plentiful, they'll be less plentiful and more expensive.
Well, they certainly will be.
Yeah.
It's going to be ruinous for the American people. And probably it's going to net bring on a next Great Depression, which we're in already, because this depression started in January of 2000. So it's already 7 years old. So it's going to go for 50 years.
We just haven't really, we haven't felt the total effects of it yet.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people think, too, I get, you know, you go back to the 1929 Depression, and a lot of people think that, you know, that day, boom, the stocks crashed and everything went to hell in a handbasket, but even that took a number of years for everything really to come to fruition, where the
Roosevelt's New Deal did nothing to help, yeah.
No.
Until 1937. In fact, a lot of people in Washington still say that Adolf Hitler saved Roosevelt's administration because it was totally bankrupt, and rearming for Hitler is the only thing that saved Roosevelt's reputation.
Well, and really, really, if you look at it, you know, the New Deal was mainly just a number of communist principles and ideas that, you know, he wrapped up, in, you know, under the term of chicken in every pot, and made everybody feel good, made it, you know, he created some jobs with his work projects, but nothing, it was nothing more than essentially communism.
Oh, well, a lot of people thought it was pure fascism. They thought it was more modeled after Hitler, Mussolini's Italy. I think it was very fascistic, and it was very communistic, too.
Yeah.
What? And it certainly didn't do anything for the country, for the people as country, because I lived through that depression. It was pretty rough.
Yeah, you know, I've known folks who lived through that, and you know, their talk, you know, was, you know, that they would never be in that situation again. And I know people who would rat hole money. You wouldn't think that they had a dime to their name, but if you went and looked at their balance sheet or their checking account, they had millions. They were loaded because they were afraid it was going to happen all over again, and so they wouldn't spend any money.
Oh, I knew people in the 50s, but they were still hoarding because of the memories of the Depression. They were hoarding soap and sugar and everything.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I knew a guy, he was my ex-wife's uncle, and the man, you know, he was wearing the same clothes he'd had for 15 years.
Oh, yes, you saw that around here. That were same suit the rest of your life.
Yeah, but you went and checked his, you know, checked his bank account, and the man was absolutely loaded. But they were saving for that rainy day because they had been through it once and were not going to go through it again. And
The Depression had a terrible effect on people. See, my father was unemployed and he had six children, and we didn't know from one day to the next whether they were going to eat or not.
Yeah.
It was grim.
Yeah, I know, and I don't think we, you know. I know I don't. I'm 40, 41, but I have no concept of what any of that's like other than what I've been told. And I know unless you've experienced it, you're not really going to know how bad it really was.
No, because the people that lived through it didn't know how bad it was. It was total despair. You had no expectation of anything. I never expected to go to college because it was just out of the question. And I went to college on the GI Bill.
Yeah. So it was just lucky for you World War II came along.
Oh, no. I could not have gone to college for that World War II.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't a penny to go to college on. Two of my brothers went to college, too, for the same reason. They were in the Army and had the Bill of Rights, and they went to college, and they got their degrees.
So I guess, all the lives that were lost in that war is, one's a crying shame, but I guess, there is an upside to it. All the soldiers that got an education and were able to make something with their lives.
Because half the people in this country who are now substantial businessmen and even millionaires, they went to college on the GI Bill, and that's the only way they could have ever done it.
Yeah. How many books have you written?
31. I've got 38 more to write. I'm working on my autobiography now, and I got other books to write. I want to write this Banker's History of the United States, and so I haven't had a day off in the last 25 years.
So you write every day?
Every day.
So you write every day then?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And I do talk shows and lectures. I've got several lectures coming up. And Sunday I broadcast all Sunday afternoon preaching to the Christian Identity Church in Colorado.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes, by telephone, of course.
Yeah.
And I have things like that every day.
Oh, wow. How many books are you planning on turning out a year? If you got 38 more to write?
Well, I could turn out three or four a year, actually, because my writing is, I've been doing it so many years and I know my subject so well that I have to do practically no rewriting. It comes out ready for the printer. I don't change a column.
This is the way it goes. Now, do you write
because it comes out of your, whole, you see. You don't have to struggle with it for 3 months to try to line it up. It comes out ready to print.
Now, do you use a typewriter or a computer?
Oh, well, I'm using a computer right now, but I'm just starting on that. I wrote my books on IBM Selectric 3 typewriters. They were terrific.
Yeah.
I used to turn out 35 pages a day on those things.
That's not bad. That's pretty good.
That's 35 pages a day. It doesn't take you long to write a 300 page book.
No, not at all. Not at all. So 38, you do that.
I can do it. I don't know whether I will or not because I'll be 85 next month. So I ought to start slowing down a little bit. But I'm going full speed because it keeps me going. Now, I have a brother-in-law up here who's retired, and he's just sits in his kitchen all day long. My sister died, and since she died, he just sits around and doesn't do anything. And he's a very active man. He could be doing a lot of things.
Well, they say that activity keeps you young.
It keeps you going. Your system, when your system becomes inactive, I was in the nursing home for a while. I had some strokes, and I was in three nursing homes, and I tell you, that was the worst ordeal I ever had in my life.
Yeah.
For the first time in my life, I wasn't working 7 days a week. It was a great rest. I think it was good for me. It probably added 5 years to my life.
Well, a chance for you to get to those 38 books.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Your wealth of knowledge, we have talked, we probably have covered 30 different subjects here in the last hour and 45 minutes, and you've been learning on all of them.
Oh, I have no notes. I don't have my books here or anything. I have no notes. And the Virginia bureaucracy, because I went after the Federal Reserve System, and so, and my driver's license came up for renewal 5 years ago. So the University of Virginia put out a story that I had totally lost my memory, and they warned the law enforcement agencies that because I had no memory, I could be driving on the road and forget where I was going and kill 300 or 400 people. And they've refused to renew my driving permit for 5 years, and I have to walk everywhere. I can't even go to the post office to mail a book.
That's incredible.
Oh, it is incredible. It's very, very inconvenient, too.
Sure, I imagine it is, especially this time of year.
Well, see, I live alone, and I'm totally responsible for my well-being. I have to do everything.
Yeah. you're gaining your popularity is resurging.
It's just surging all the time. It's really, I wasn't really looking for it. I wasn't even anticipating it. It just started surging a couple of years ago on the internet, and I wasn't prepared for it at all. I was preparing to retire. And now it looks like retiring is out of the question.
Now, are most of your books still in print?
No, but five of my best ones are out of print. And in fact, internet was offering the other day for a copy of my Curse of Canaan, which is one of my best books. And somebody's offering $5,000 for a copy of the one book. And some of the other books are regularly offered at $500 to $1,000.
Yeah. And you've got an eBay store where if people want your books, they can get them there.
Oh, yeah. Well, I have a friend working with me now, and he put me on eBay. So we're selling some books through there. But I wasn't out to sell any books at all. I was ready to retire and take it easy.
Yeah.
There's not much chance of...
No, that's about it right there. And even that, for some reason, that piece didn't complete as well. So, but like I said, I'll get the complete interview for you up and running and get it up on the website tomorrow. And my apologies for it not going all the way through. I don't know what it was. I think maybe the CD is just, as I say, foobard. That's the only thing I can think of. So there it is. But Eustace Mullins, a rather interesting individual. As we mentioned, he has an eBay store. And you can go to eBay.com and just type in Eustace Mullins. And that will bring up his little story. He's got four or five books there. I know one of them is $10. And one of them is his Curse of Canaan book, which is pretty rare. Last I saw it was selling for like $115. But he was telling me there were some people on the internet that were selling a copy of that same book for $5,000. So it's a rare book, and he's a rare individual indeed. And I feel absolutely, privileged to have had the chance to talk with him and spend that little bit of time with him as he waited. He held his dinner off for me and everything to talk with us. But we'll have the complete interview up.